This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Sue Balcom talks about planting garlic, but we are going to start with finding art in unexpected places. That is a passion of artist Nicole Gagner, the founder of Meadowlark Mercantile. She recently got a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts to use old vending machines and put art inside of them. Gagner partnered with Justin Cancellieri, the executive director of the Bizman Writers Guild, to put homemade zines in one of those machines. I caught up with them at Dialectic Brewing in Mandan. What is a Meadowlark Mercantile?
The idea started, how do we collect artists together and get them showing their art in different places? The biggest arm of that right now is our art vending machine adventure, which has been really, really fun to collect art in refurbished vending machines. Each vending machine comes with its own little quirks and problems, but the best part really is getting artists' work in there. It's all local artists, and really the only thing that we give them is, here are the dimensions for the vending machine coil, then you get to make what you want to make in it usually. So that's really fun.
So it's like art the size of a Snickers bar usually?
Yeah, exactly. So our vending machines are all refurbished snack machines. So usually about the size of a bag of chips or a size of a candy bar, or there are some even gum-sized ones in there. So you can get really creative within those different parameters.
Are you limited to being able to charge only as much as a typical vending machine? Usually you kind of top out around the $2 mark at a vending machine.
Yeah, so that's actually part of the model that we have, is we have different styles of vending machines. Some of them are older machines that only take coin and cash, and then some of them do take credit cards. So depending on the location, like we have one up at the Visitor Center in Bismarck, and that one takes credit card, but here at Dialectic, it takes cash, but Dialectic is a bar, so they have cash. So we kind of get to play within those parameters of like what works best in which place, and all of the places that have hosted them have been so great about like, oh yeah, try it out, see what works, and if we want to change it out and try something else later, they're fine with it. So that's great.
What is the Bizman Writers Guild? What is your interest in collaboration with this project?
The biggest thing was to collaborate with artists. And this is our second collaboration. We started with The Art of Writing, which is a traveling art show. And so I think just collaborating with artists and getting the saturation from both sides is the biggest advantage here, and I love doing the collaboration for sure.
What is that, the Art of Writing project?
It was similar to the zine project, where we would pair artists and writers together to base pieces off of each other's work. The zine project was a little bit different, where most of the artists based art on the writing, where it was kind of the opposite for the Art of Writing, where it was one or the other chose a piece to base an original piece on.
So zine is a short magazine? Is there more to it than that?
I just had to explain this to somebody else. So a zine, and this Nicole might be able to answer this better than I could, because Nicole and my wife Shelley knew this way more than I did, but a zine is apparently from the 80s, 90s-ish era, where people would cut up paper or fold paper and just cut stuff out of other magazines, put it in there. Some people would write manifestos in them, or just kind of short stories like we did. Apparently I wasn't the cool kid to do this, because I had never heard of a zine until Ben came to me with it.
Yeah, zines have really punk rock origins of very DIY, and you would make something in black and white and photocopy it at Kinko's and then hand it out. which I am all about that. We did have help printing it. It wasn't out of Kinko's, but we kind of took that idea of DIYing it and collaborating, and they are still all in black and white. They're not like literally cut up and copied and pasted, though. We worked with really talented illustrators that made beautiful illustrations to go with the stories. So we kind of made our own hybrid out of it.
So what kinds of pieces are in this vending machine?
This one was specifically for spooky stories. If this goes all according to plan, we're planning on continuing with different holidays like Valentine's Day, so do love stories and stuff like that. But it was something new and different.
With the whole spooky theme, on top in the vending machine are all of the zines, and then on bottom are different spooky art from different local artists. And so that's something that we could definitely do in the future if we did another collaboration, like, oh, if we're doing Valentine's stories, or do artists want to make love-themed things or something else? Like, what's their interpretation of Valentine's Day? Because that's why it's so fun. You just kind of leave it up to the artists and say, this is your size. You get to set your price and tell us what you want to make.
So spooky, I get it. We're in October. It's the time of year where everybody loves spooky. But Justin, you have written quite a bit about paranormal topics. That's kind of an interest zone of yours. What draws you to the realm of the mythical, mystical, paranormal?
I've been paranormal podcasting for 13 years. I was doing paranormal investigations when I lived in Cleveland, Ohio. And, you know, from a young age, it was always an interest, you know, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster. I ended up using a Ouija board as a kid, which apparently is a huge no-no. And that led to, you know, doing tarot cards and stuff, and then start really opening myself up to the spiritual.
What do you mean when you say opening yourself up to the spiritual?
Most people don't know this, but I am psychic sensitive. I've been actually going kind of through a growth spurt in the past few years of that, and so it's been kind of different, because when I first started, I could just like feel things, but now I'm like hearing things and seeing things, so it's a much different feeling than just, oh, hey, there's a ghost here.
What do you think is the number one misconception when you say psychic? Most people just think of those old call-in things for Dionne Warwick, or at least that's what I think of. Maybe I'm dating myself for when you could call into Dionne Warwick. But what do you think are the misconceptions about that?
I think the biggest misconception is all psychics are frauds. That's where the psychic medium really comes in. And again, there are quite a few people that will think a medium is a fraud as well. But personal experience for me, most of the psychics that I've talked to are not. They know things that they should not know. And I think that is the hugest misconception is, oh, they could have just looked that up.
Is it an abuse of power if I ask you to tell me something about Nicole? What's the reaction been to the vending machine so far?
Yeah, so far the reaction's been fabulous. So we've only had the one up at the CVB there since September, and now this one in October. We also had a pop-up at Bismarck's TEDx event. And that was really fun because I got to hang out there and go to the TEDx event, but also see people's reactions to it. I knew that people were enjoying it and having fun, but to see people actually being like, oh my gosh, it's falling. And it's like, you're an adult, you know how a vending machine works, but it was just joy, you know, it was just so fun. You don't have that reaction to a Snickers bar. And people are discovering new artists through it. They're finding things that they haven't seen anywhere else. We also have a selection of locally sourced vintage things in there. So that could be anything from, you know, pins from governor's campaigns 30 years ago to old, you know, interesting Elks Club enamel pins, things like that. Just a whole selection of fun stuff like that. So, and it gets catered to each place that it's in. At a visitor center, you want North Dakota themed stuff. Here, it's for Halloween. We want spooky stuff. But the next place that we're going into has a lot of kids that come through the door. So what do artists want to make, you know, for kids and parents? We also have a collaboration, another like writer-friendly collaboration with the Bismarck-Mandan Public Library, where they are curating used books and repackaging them. So it's like, find your next favorite book, and it just has a description on the cover where somebody has chosen a book for you and they've described it to you. So you can decide if you want to read it, but it's going to be a complete surprise to you when you get it out of the vending machine and unwrap it. So just, and that's just all creative collaboration that this vending machine has allowed.
How often does the Bisman Writers Guild meet up, either Zoom or in person?
It's been at least once a month, but we also have write-ins, people getting together and writing. We have been doing workshops at least twice a month as well.
How do you describe the writing community in Bismarck? Are people pretty open and friendly? Are there a lot of people? Some people are kind of shy about sharing their work. What's your classification?
It's like herding a bunch of cats. I think that's artists as a whole herding a bunch of cats. But overall, it's been a very welcoming experience for everybody. They didn't know what it was at first. And a lot of people, if I go to events, I'll ask them, you know, have you heard of the Bisman Writers Guild? Well, yes or no. Are you a writer? Well, yeah, but I've never been published. Well, that's why it's not the Bisman Authors Guild. It's the Bisman Writers Guild. We're here to help people of all faiths, all walks of life, help them with their writing, even if it's for themselves, for their family, or if they're trying to get published.
Do you have a lot of members?
We are at 175 members right now.
Over how many years has that taken to grow?
We started as just a group in 2019, went nonprofit last year, and so it's been 3 years. Started out with myself, a couple family members from outside of North Dakota, and a couple of writers that I met just doing different events.
Assuming there's no such thing as like a normal meeting, but can you kind of walk us through what a meeting would be like?
First and foremost, to join the guild, it's completely free. We don't charge our members for any of it. But a meeting, basically, we talk about people's goals for the month. We set goals. The following month, we ask people if they met their goals, set new goals for the month. Talk about what events we're going to be doing for the month, the workshops we're going to be working on, ask people what works in progress they're working on. Really, we are trying to make it about them rather than the organization.
And Nicole, outside of these vending machines, you do a lot of painting yourself, and I've even seen you making your own paint.
Yeah.
Have you always been an artist?
I've always been creative. I definitely came from a family of people that were very creative, but nobody up until me claimed the title of artist. But I've always done creative things and enjoyed expressing myself. And now I really enjoy, you know, kind of like Justin said, you don't have to be published to be an author. You don't have to have sold a painting to be an artist. There's so many different ways to be an artist. You don't even have to paint to be an artist. But if you like to paint, if you want to dabble in something, if you have any creative way that you want to figure out how to express yourself, I love working with people to help them figure that out. I love working in my studio, but I also love working with other people, helping them figure out what makes them happy, what creative outlet is just going to be enjoyable for them. And that's something that is important for people of any age. I work with young kids. I work with the Burleigh County Senior Center. I work with everybody in between because creative expression is really important. And not everybody can do it so well with words. Some people need like a visual outlet or something, some other way to express themselves.
When you said you came from creatives, but you're the first person to kind of call yourself an artist, was it hard for you to step into that role and to say, I am an artist? Just the process of claiming that.
I think I did luck out in going to college and immersing myself with art professors who were living the life of working as an artist, but also not doing the starving artist thing. It's apparently not necessary. So I learned, yeah, exactly. I learned that there are a lot of other ways to make it work. And that's why I love still working with, you know, young artists of all ages to help them figure out, like, there's not just one way to be an artist. There's a million different ways, and there's new ones being invented all of the time. In fact, now vending machine art is apparently a thing. So there's new stuff happening all of the time. But seeing professors that were working artist professionals helped me realize how much was out there and available.
How did the pandemic impact your creative process?
It has definitely gotten to my motivation a little bit. I have to force myself to be in the writing mode. When I get there, I'm fine. But to work all day and fight with different things going on in the pandemic in my normal work, and then to come home and try and do writing, it's a little rough.
Artists pivot. We are pretty used to things not working out as we planned. That's actually a huge part of my creative process, is what isn't working and then how can I fix that. So last year, when everything was really closing down, I had the idea with a couple other people, including Justin actually, to do something called a virtual studio crawl. We don't have a studio crawl in Bismarck, but we were able to do one online where we just got to see creatives at home doing their process. The Writers Guild came and did some readings. There were artists in their studios. There were musicians. There were wood turners. Just, it was so fun to see how much creativity was still happening in our community. So that was really inspiring. Yeah, just taking stuff online. It's all possible to do online if you have, you know, a network of people to all learn from each other. It's, being in person is more fun, but being online together is better than nothing.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
That was artist and founder of Meadowlark Mercantile, Nicole Gagner, and the executive director of the Bisman Writers Guild, Justin Cancellieri. You can find out more at nicolegagner.wixsite.com and bismanwritersguild.wixsite.com. Tom Ezern is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Next Blue of North Dakota. All-in-one Medicare Advantage plans made for North Dakotans by North Dakotans. For whatever's next, nextbluend.com.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we answer many listener questions and spend a great deal of time talking about the midnight ride of Jack Jewett.
The poet Longfellow immortalized Paul Revere, of course, in the midnight ride of Paul Revere. But Jack Jewett was maybe a more extraordinary messenger who got the word to the governor's council and Jefferson in Virginia that the British are coming. The British are coming.
We also talked about Edward Curtis and about Anton Johansson and his 9-page book list.
Jefferson loved to offer lists of books that young people should read, particularly young men, and he made his library available under certain very controlled conditions to people that he thought might treat it with full respect.
This week's episode is devoted to answering listener questions. Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and historians learn their craft through many sources. There are, of course, first-person accounts, newspaper articles, the archaeological record, and then there are songs. In this week's Plains Folk essay, historian Tom Ezern is looking for more in Searchlight for Cowboy Ballads.
If you're a regular listener to Plains Folk, then you know that I am on the hunt for the folk songs of the Great Plains, which produced an amazing efflorescence of balladry in the generations of the original Euro-American settlers and their children. It is an old prairie trail that I follow on this quest, one blazed by the song catchers of the early 20th century, foremost among whom was John Lomax. I have his autobiography, Adventures of a Ballad Hunter. And who knows, perhaps some blessed Christmas, Dr. K will gift me with a first edition of Lomax's cowboy songs, and other frontier ballads. Although I prize texts of ballads I have collected word of mouth, right now I'm expanding the literary base exponentially by going digital, gillnetting the digital archives of prairie newspapers for forgotten folk songs, versions, and stanzas. Imagine my surprise and delight when one day recently my path crossed that of the eminent Professor Lomax himself. In the early 20th century, historical researchers of all sorts were severely limited by the logistics of travel. To cover any extent of ground, you had to go by rail, and railroads only went where they cared to, generally along east-west lines. Lomax was at Texas A&M University, College Station. There was no way he could extend his collection of Western folk song to the northern plains, except through correspondence and the cooperation of those fixtures in all prairie towns, the newspapers. So here I am, perusing the pages of The Searchlight, the newspaper of Culbertson, Montana, way out in the Highline Country. And who should I meet but Professor Lomax in the person of his circular letter received and published by The Searchlight on the 8th of January, 1909. For several years, writes Lomax, I have been endeavoring to make a complete collection of the native ballads and songs of the West, particularly those known as cowboy songs. It will hardly be possible to secure such a collection except through the aid of the press. Such songs, he writes, deal with frontier episodes, the deeds of desperados like Jesse James and Sam Bass, the life of the ranger in pursuit of Indians or desperados, the experiences of the cowboy going up the trail, the trials of the 49ers, buffalo hunters, stage drivers, and freighters. In short, they are attempts, often crude, sometimes vulgar, to epitomize and particularize the life of the pioneers who peopled the vast region west of the Mississippi River. Such pioneer ballads do exist. Yours very respectfully, John A. Lomax, Associate Professor of English. The editor of The Searchlight gleefully agrees to shine his beam on the subject, asking readers to send in their contributions. First, from Mrs. W. S. Evans comes a lengthy compilation of stanzas entitled At a Cowboy Dance, which opens, "Get your little sage hens ready. Trot 'em out upon the floor. Stop your cussin', cocinero, for the ladies. Now all set." Then, from Mrs. George Reynolds comes a sublime version of The Dying Cowboy. "Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie." And then, Mirabile dictu. From A.A. Phillips in Circle, Montana, comes a set of stanzas with the heading Buffalo Home. But we know them as Home on the Range. This contribution, along with another text about the same time from Grand Forks, North Dakota, constitute firm evidence of the currency of this lyric classic on the Northern Plains. All right, I'm done for today. I've got to get back to the hunt for ballads.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, everything you wanted to know about Indians but were afraid to ask. We share an excerpt from a recent Humanities ND Game Changer event. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says he doesn't see much support for dipping into the state's general fund surplus when lawmakers meet in November. Governor Doug Burgum wants lawmakers to approve income tax relief, more spending on economic development, and shoring up the state's pension fund using that surplus. That would be in addition to the Federal America Recovery Plan Act money. Wardner says there is no appetite for that.
There are a few individuals that think we should do something with it, but right now I don't see enough support to do anything with that. And personally, I think we should save that for the regular session coming up in 23.
Burgum has asked his supporters to sign an online petition to support those proposals for that surplus. Minnesota could soon have a state fossil. The Science Museum of Minnesota is nominating a giant beaver specimen to be the official fossil. More than 11,000 people chose it from the museum's collection. The giant beaver is a 200-pound bear-sized version of the common beaver that still inhabits Minnesota. Museum Chair of Paleontology Alex Hastings announced the results.
Beavers still throughout all of Minnesota today. They're an important part of the ecosystems here. A lot of people have seen them and learned to love these little toothy critters. So why wouldn't you love an even larger version of that?
Minnesota is one of only a few states that don't have an official state fossil. The Minnesota legislature will be asked to make the official designation. The North Dakota state fossil is Teredo petrified wood. A teredo is a mollusk-like creature that burrowed its way through trees growing near warm water swamps in North Dakota 60 to 80 million years ago. And a lucky North Dakota Powerball player became a millionaire overnight. A $1 million Powerball ticket for Wednesday night's draw was sold at the Cenex C store at the 9th Street North and Highway 210 bypass in Wahpeton.
So we've had some pretty big ones this year. Actually, with this $1 million Powerball winner that was sold at that Cenex C store, that retailer had actually sold $1 million Powerball tickets back in March of 2013. So that's a very lucky store.
Ryan Coppy with the State Lottery in Bismarck says the winner has not yet come forward. The Cenex C store will receive a $5,000 bonus for selling the winning ticket. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Next time on The Pulse, Jessie Flynn was diagnosed with MS in her 30s, and the illness quickly wrecked her life. It took her ability to move freely. She could no longer work.
I mean, I was stripped down to nothing.
Then she decided to try an experimental treatment, even though it was a big risk.
I'm not willing to wait anymore.
That's The Pulse, coming up at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Dr. Anton Troyer is a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. He has written a lot of books, including Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. Recently, he appeared in a webinar as part of Humanities ND's Game Changers series. You can hear the entire session on our air this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central, but today we share an excerpt as he visits with Russ McDonald, president of the United Tribes Technical College.
I think, you know, something else that's important, you know, when we talk about historical injustices and historical trauma, something else that's important to remind people, especially when we're in mixed company, is as Native people, we are more than the sum of our tragedies. And a lot of times there's actually a really good TED Talk called The Danger of a Single Story. And in that TED Talk, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, she's this Nigerian literary figure, gives this TED Talk. And she talks about how if you get a really narrow single story narrative and use that to understand a whole group of people, you're going to get it wrong. And the reason is that stereotypes are not necessarily incorrect so much as they are incomplete. Like you could look at one single story narrative about what it means to be white in America and just look at, you know, poor white people in Appalachia. And you'd be thinking, man, no work ethic. Look at the meth. It's just terrible. You know, but that's not the experience of all white people in America. You could also look at another single story narrative about, you know, white people on New York's Upper East Side and be thinking, wow, everything handed on a silver platter. That's not the whole experience of every white person in America. So there's no single story narrative. As Native people, we are not governed by one single story of our experience. There are many, many different tribes, many different experiences. There are urban natives and res natives. There's a range of experiences with regard to poverty, health, language, culture, you know, so many different things. And so there's always a lot more than the tip of the iceberg that you might see when you first meet someone. And it's really healthy and helpful to abandon the single story narrative just about, you know, like imagine the one that says natives are all living in squalor on a reservation somewhere. and another one that says we're all rich from casinos. How can they both tell you everything you need to know? You know, obviously it's complicated. And so it's good to ask questions and look for the answers.
I agree. And, you know, even like the boarding school experiences, my dad felt it was a positive experience. He said we had 3 square meals a day. Yeah. We had clean sheets and every week and felt pretty positive about it. My uncle, on the other hand, who's the brother of my dad, felt negative about it. And they beat him for praying in our language, you know. So I think there's 2 different stories within the same family in regard to just what transpired within the boarding school system. But to kind of focus in and stuff, and I'm real curious in regard to just the author piece. And I mean, I've written publications and thesis and dissertation, but I've never really wrote in regard to the good work that you're doing. And so when did you first realize you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, yeah. I think, honestly, I can tell you how I came upon this project, which is one of my first books, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. And I think going through middle and high school was a really tough experience for me. I experienced, you know, some pretty rough, even physical violence, racist stuff. And I thought, man, when I finish high school, I'm getting out of here and I'm never coming back. And I realize a lot of kids of all kinds of backgrounds have that thought when they're finishing high school. And I applied to colleges and surprised everyone, myself most of all, when I got into Princeton University. And so I cruised across the country, and all of a sudden I went from being like an Indian to being the Indian. I think there were like 5 other Native people at the university. I was the first and only Ojibwe person there at the time. And there's nothing like leaving home to make you appreciate what you just left behind. And all of a sudden I started getting homesick and things like that. And I did form great friendships. In fact, my freshman year assigned roommate, who was from Sri Lanka, a little island off the coast of India, we were besties all the way through college and roomed together 4 years in a row. And I had lots of wonderful friends who challenged me, you know, asking questions that I didn't really have the answers for. I knew what it was like to live in this body, to have a brown skin, to have braids, you know, man bun today. But, you know, I knew what that was like, but I had the same education most other Americans did too, you know? So my mother had ended up becoming the first female Native attorney in the state of Minnesota. And we went from, you know, outhouse and a hand pump and washing up in the river in the summer and, you know, enamel wash basins in the winter. By the time I hit middle school, she built a nice house. And still, like, after all of that, watching her grow and get her law degree and all this, like, I couldn't have explained tribal sovereignty to you coming out of high school, you know? And so when I got to Princeton, at some point, getting homesick, I heard that there was this woman coming. She was like a Comanche spiritual leader, and Princeton's out in New Jersey, and she was coming to run sweat lodge ceremonies. And so the thought occurred to me, this could be a crazy person, right? There's nut jobs. What's the Comanche are from Oklahoma and Texas. What are they doing in New Jersey? You know, is this like culture for sale kind of situation or what? But so those thoughts were there, but I said, well, I'll check it out and see if it's anything like home. And I got there, and there were about 20 white folk waiting for a sweat lodge ceremony. They're all white. It's about 4 in the afternoon. They're standing around in the broad daylight, and they were all completely naked. They didn't have any clothes on. And so I'm pulling up, and I'm like, part of me wants to laugh because, dang, you know, there's 20 naked people standing around in the woods. And part of me wants to run because, dang, there's 20 naked people standing around in the woods. But part of me is also really mad, like, dang, is that what they think we're all about? And then being naive, I opened a car door and I got folded into a tight embrace by one of these naked strangers who's now hugging me close and saying, I'm so sorry what my people did to your people. So now, awkward, the desire to like laugh, run, get mad is just growing. And I looked at this woman's face. She was an elder. And there were tears welling up in her eyes. And it occurred to me that if I just left, she'd keep thinking whatever misguided stuff she was thinking. If I got mad and told her off, I was probably the first real native she ever met. And she'd be thinking that's how all natives are. And so I had to think fast. This is something that happens to people of color that doesn't happen to white folk as much, where you get asked to be the spokesperson for a whole group of people, which is never fair. But anyways, I had to think fast. And so I told her, I said, ma'am, could you put some clothes on? Because I would love to talk to you about all of this. And she did. And we actually had a good conversation. And I think she came away with a different point of view. But in a weird way, I did too. And what I learned is that it's really important to make some safe space, to try to give people a meaningful answer, not just an angry rebuke. And since then, I started saving up the questions. Is it Indian, Native American, Aboriginal, Indigenous, First Nation person, or what? You know, also, what is going on with Native languages? What do you think about mascots? What do you think about Dakota Access Pipeline? What do you think about, you know, Indigenous environmental issues, climate change? What is tribal sovereignty? What about casinos, good or bad? You know, these kind of things, that questions that we all often get. And some of the answers I knew from my lived experience, but a lot of them I had to hunt for. And as I did, I really started to learn a lot. And I never really thought, it was kind of like Forrest Gump, after I started this process, everywhere I went, I was running. I never thought it would take me anywhere. And I started to write them up. I started actually by giving talks and just sharing what I was learning. But then I started writing it up and turned into a book. And that was one of the first projects. There was a parallel journey for me too. When I finished college, I probably traumatized my parents because I said, this is it. I'm coming home. I'm not taking a job. I'm not going to grad school. I'm going to walk the earth and I'm going to hang out with our elders and I'm going to learn more about our language and culture. And they're like, well, you're a college graduate, so good luck paying for that because we're done, you know. But I worked it out and I ended up spending a lot of time with this elder who, he was born in 1901. His Ojibwe was great. He was kind of clunky in English. He actually couldn't read or write in English. But one of the best educated people I knew. And so I really took a deep dive with our language and culture. Eventually, I applied to grad school and, you know, to do oral history and work with our language and, you know, it grew into a career.
That was Anton Troyer talking with Russ McDonald, president of United Tribes Technical College. You can hear the entire conversation this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. Sue Balcom is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. We were supposed to celebrate Prairie Public's 40th anniversary in style with a swanky in-person celebration with dinner, live music, and all the trimmings. But, you know, the pandemic. But alas, along comes the internet. Join Prairie Public Sunday, October 17th at 5 p.m. Central for a live Zoom event. You'll get to see Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal banter with Prairie Public News Director and our first voice, Dave Thompson, about memorable Prairie Public moments. Plus, he'll challenge Dave with an amusing new game in typical Wait, Wait style. But you gotta register for this free Zoom event. Just go to prairiepublic.org.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Congrats, Dave, and way to go, Prairie Public.
Celebrate 4 decades of Prairie Public with us without leaving the comfort of your own screen. That's Sunday, October 17th at 5 p.m. Central on Zoom. Sponsored in part by Bremer Bank, Basin Electric Power Cooperative, North Dakota Association of Rural Electric Cooperatives, and Vogel Law Firm.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now from our Bismarck studio is root seller Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the root seller's farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And it sounds funny to say, but you're out planting things right now.
Oh my gosh, more than a couple of things. I actually started doing some cover cropping this year, and I've had fairly decent success with that. I'm so excited to see where that goes. But we have to plant our garlic also this time of year. Otherwise, it just doesn't get big and beautiful. And there was a huge demand for garlic at the farmer's market this summer. But I also had like an abundance of cucumbers, and therefore I needed to keep a lot of my garlic myself. But yes, this is the time of year where you want to prepare your beds and get your garlic planted. It is an easy, it's easy, easy to grow. It is actually really a lot of fun to go out and plant this time of year.
I just kind of
makes you feel good, even though you're tired from harvesting everything. But it's like you got to plan for the next season, you know, like I'm ordering seeds and I'm making notes about things I should and shouldn't do. We do live in probably zone four. I don't know. You guys are you three on the other side of the state?
I think we're
there?
Right on the edge of
you're
three. Kind of,
yeah. And it's been changing. There's actually, right. We're getting a little closer to five. But we are considered a cold climate with a short growing season. And so I usually like to plant hardneck garlic, something like Music or German Red. And that is, well, right now I'm hoping you guys all bought your garlic because it's really hard to find as the season wears down.
Sure.
People are, you know, planning ahead and then pretty soon like, oh, we don't have any garlic left. So I've ordered mine. I'm anxiously awaiting for it to come because I like to get in the ground before October 15th. I plant hardneck garlic, but my husband has a friend who is convinced that we can grow softneck garlic up here. The difference between the two is that the hardneck will grow and produce a scape. And as you know, garlic scape pesto is one of my favorite foods in the whole world. And those are saleable at farmers market. So you actually get a double duty crop off of your garlic. However, who doesn't want to hang a couple garlic braids next to their doors at Halloween to keep the vampires away? The softneck garlic has no garlic scape, and the tops are pliable. So when you dig that soft stuff out of the ground, then you can braid those into those cool garlic braids. And so I thought, well, you know, this friend of JC's offered us some free softneck garlic seed because he's trying to increase his production every year, you know, like exponentially. We plant garlic, we sell a few cloves or bulbs, we use it for our own salsa and pickles and things like that. But I also hold the biggest bulbs back to replant again in the fall.
And how do you plant them?
It's fairly easy. You want to, like I said, pick your best bulbs and peel the outside off and break them into cloves or toes. We've always called them toes. Some people are like, well, I don't know what that is. Well, there's usually, like in the hardneck varieties, I've got some the big and beautiful bulbs, and they only have three toes, whereas the softneck garlic is a smaller version of the garlic, and it has, you know, at least five little toes on it. And so you bust those apart and put them in a box. Now, if you're particular about like what kind of garlic is planted in what row and how straight it is, then you'll have to, you know, like you'll have to get someone out there to help you engineer that, because I'm really bad about that. But I'm going to try to be better this year. I'm going to try to keep my soft away from my hard neck so we can kind of compare notes. What you want to do is prepare your bed. You know, like we re-harrow our beds in the fall and then we harrow them again in the spring.
Is this one of those plants you're supposed to mound?
No.
No.
Okay. No, actually, you don't have to mound anything. When they say plant in a hill, that does not mean excavating a hill in your garden. That just means putting three little seeds in a pile in your hole there so that one out of those three come up. That's cute. I love that. So
I'm a very literal person.
Right. I think I used to hill my squash seeds too, like pound up a little hill there. And then I'm like, I guess it doesn't even make any sense to do that. Like, why am I doing this? And then somebody gave me permission not to. And so, isn't that how that goes?
That is how that goes, yeah.
So, and it is an allium. So it's you know, watch your crop rotation. You know, you want to make sure that you're not planting garlic in garlic. It's a heavy feeder. You don't want to plant garlic over garlic beds or onion beds from the previous year. But you can, like I did this with my onions this year. I planted cabbage onions in order for the aroma to deter some pests. And they say garlic does that too, but it's a very difficult thing to plant your garlic in the fall. Try to find it in the spring when it's time to plant the cabbage.
Oh, you know? That.
You have to really mark your rows if you're going to do something like
Not pencil.
And I'm always tripping over those strings and stuff and pulling those stakes out. And, oh, goodness sakes. garlic gets along with a lot of plants, so you can pick up, you know, any little square portion of your garden, but not near asparagus, peas, beans, parsley, strawberries, you know, just like you don't plant peas near onions, it kind of stunts their growth a little bit. So we've got our area picked out on one end of the garden, and we actually will block that off very carefully so we don't plow over it in the spring when we're getting ready to plant our other crops. And then basically you take your toe and you plant it 3 inches down into the soil with the pointy end up. There's a root end and a pointy end, and you have to make sure you get the right one up, or it'll take a little longer for it to grow down and then sideways and then come up.
Around, it's like,
it does. They actually do that. I've seen that happen when I have the little girls out planting, but they're pretty good about that. So here's the trick. Is that just like some flower bulbs, you want to get your garlic in the ground so it has a minimum of 2 weeks' time to establish a beautiful root before the weather gets bad. So what I did for y'all is I went ahead and took a very close look at a couple of weather forecasts for October. And so I usually plant on the 15th. This year I'm going to plant a little bit earlier because my schedule would dictate that I need to get that done before I leave for vacation. But anytime between August 1st and October 1st is supposed to be, acceptable. I would wait because we have a chance of getting like extremely hot weather here. All you want is for it to not freeze for 2 weeks. Once it's in the ground and watered in really well, you can throw a little blood meal or bone meal on it. That will help. It likes nitrogen. It really, really is a heavy feeding plant. And it doesn't like to be in weeds. And I had a lot of weeds this summer, man. It was just too much for me.
Needs my space.
Weeds really like the hot weather, too. So, but this year I'm going to plant in a better bed than I did last year, and I'm going to really, 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 really try to do this as an experiment to see whether I can get that soft neck to grow as well as the hard neck does.
All right.
So mulch it after you water, throw that blood meal on there. You want to put, 2 or 3 inches at least of grass clippings, not grass clippings with pesticides on, and not new grass clippings, but dried grass clippings or straw, and that will help you remember where your actual bed is planted. And then in the spring, they should come up when they want to come up. So you kind of like every once in a while in April, you're kind of parting the way there and looking to see what the growth is like, and then you can rake that off of there and fertilize them again and start watering them, and ta-da, it starts all over again. You'll have a wonderful garlic harvest by July.
We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thank you, Sue.
Thanks, Ashley.
Weekends are meant for listening to Prairie Public. Whether it's the fun learning about language on Away With Words, the laugh at the news till you hurt on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the exquisite storytelling and sound designs of This American Life, Radiolab, and Snap Judgment, informative deep dives you'll hear on Reveal, the TED Radio Hour, and Planet Money, or the Moth's live storytelling without a net, there's something for every taste, interest, and mood Saturday and Sunday on Prairie Public. Listen in your car while out running errands or while doing chores at home on your smart speaker. Just ask it to play Prairie Public. You'll be glad you listened.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 14th. Wahpeton was in a tizzy on June 10, 1897, as the Ringling Brothers Circus train pulled into town. A crowd gathered to watch the unloading of the flashy white horses, the exotic animals, and the gaudy circus wagons. Children gathered, hoping to be chosen as temporary help, since the circus gave free tickets to boys who helped hoist the big main tent. People were not deterred by the dark storm clouds that began to fill the sky. They weren't about to let a little rain spoil a once-in-a-lifetime chance to see such a well-known circus. They would be safely under the cover of the sprawling circus tent. It never occurred to anyone that the day would end in tragedy. The storm rolled in. The rains came. During the arrival parade, wagons pulled by horses bogged down in mud, and elephants had to push them out. As the boys began to hoist the big tent, they were no match for the wind and rain. The crew foreman had to cut holes in the canvas to free the water and lighten the load. The boys still couldn't handle the job. The circus roustabouts pushed the boys aside, saying, "This is man's work." They didn't realize that in putting up the main pole, they had created a giant lightning rod. When the center pole was struck, Charles Smith and Charles Walters were killed instantly. Foreman Charles Miller would later die from his injuries. Several other roustabouts and performers were stunned. Spectators took shelter under the big tent. Despite the terrible accident, the show went on. After the show, the men who had been killed were buried in Riverside Cemetery. Pieces of the shattered tent pole marked their graves. On this date in 1897, the Langdon Courier-Democrat informed readers that Ringling Brothers had replaced the broken tent pole with a marble monument. It represents the remains of the original tent pole, wound with a rope and pulley. A hammer and tent stake are at the bottom of the monument. Even today, when the circus is in town, members of the circus crew will go to the cemetery and pay their respects. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Ahmaud Arbery was killed while jogging down a residential street.
This is where it was, right here.
The white men who pursued and shot him were not immediately arrested.
They were given a courtesy that the normal citizen would not have received.
Now a murder trial is set to begin in Georgia, and a community is demanding change. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. to 9 central, here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, ever told yourself or a panicking kid to slow down and take a deep breath? It helps us to relax when we're angry, sad, or panicking. And yoga is all about breathing and mindful movement. We catch up with three people associated with the North Dakota Yoga Conference. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.